You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Ring Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
Good morning, listeners. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And whether you are joining us from listening to our podcast or listening us to live, we are very glad that to have you. It's a good fine Friday morning on the 15th of August, and you're joined today by myself, Jacob Antwerfer, as one of your presenters, and we have our co-presenter.
This is Chloe on the line, and good morning, Jacob. Good morning, everyone. And before we begin our program, 3CR and Green Left would like to recognise that the show is being broadcasted on the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people. These are the original rightful sovereign owners of the land. Australia was founded on the attempted genocide and dispossession of the First People, and we recognise that this attempted genocide is ongoing. As socialists, we pledge to actively support decolonisation and stand with all First Peoples in their struggle for justice and right to land.
Thanks for that. Chloe. So just to give a bit of a rundown on what we have coming up on our program this week, we have two interviews kind of booked for this program, and of course we'll be discussing some of the latest kind of political developments that have happened in the past week as well. But for the first main part of the program, we're going to be playing an interview with Malaysian socialist Amanda Shawata Lewis from the Socialist Party of Malaysia. So this is an interview that was part of the Green Left show. So that we'll be playing that pre-recording around 7:20 a.m. or 7:15 a.m. And then around 8:10 a.m. we're going to be interviewing Caroline Smith, who is actually part of the Global Movement to Gaza, and which is actually an organisation that has been very much been part of mobilising around the Freedom Flotilla to break the siege on Gaza. But it's also been doing a lot of things around, you know, organising kind of civil, being part of a number of civil kind of society kind of actions that have attempted to kind of break the siege on Gaza worldwide. So we're looking forward to hearing from Caroline, who's actually based in Boolaroo in Western Australia. So it's going to be probably going to be quite early for her when we interview. But yeah, it should be a good interview.
Looking forward to that one. Yeah, and before we go into our first interview, we'll just go into some headline news. And most of you may know that the Australian government has followed other Western governments and recently pledged in the last week to recognise a Palestinian state. But there are a few conditions attached, aren't there, Jacob? Let's read some of the conditions that Australia has attached to the recognition of Palestine. Some of it includes a demilitarised Palestine, recognising Israel's right to exist in peace and security, the Palestinian Authority holding elections and undertaking governance reforms, including education system reforms, to not promote further violence, and no role for Hamas. And, you know, our first thoughts in that is, how dare they place these conditions on Palestine when Gaza is basically has been reduced to rubble? And it's really an insulting, quite disgusting conditions that they've placed. I think also Western foreign ministers like Penny Wong, should be more honest because, you know, they're not going to punish, it doesn't seem like they're going to punish the Israeli government for its war crimes. But this recent declaration about Palestinian people having the right to a state, it's not really going to have an impact with Israel anyway. And they know that, and they should just be honest about that. This whole thing about Palestinian statehood, I mean, while we do want equality for all, it's this whole, like, declaration and sort of, you know, putting it out there to the Australian people that, you know, we want Palestinian statehood, it's really to kill the Palestine movement here. It is a bit of a PR campaign by Western countries to really distract people from our concrete demands and the demands of Palestinians to sanction Israel, to cut military ties, actually all ties with Israel, and to massively expand aid and rebuild Gaza. Because, you know, I mean, we're not going to forget about Israel's war crimes, and the West has really no right to demand Palestinians cease their resistance before the occupation has ended and Palestine is liberated. But there's more to say on this. You know, maybe Jacob has some thoughts as well.
Yeah, so just to add a few things. I mean, looking, I guess, at it from a kind of different sort of angle, I mean, I would argue that the fact that the Labor government has made this move to recognise Palestine and in fact, the fact that they've actually committed to recognition before the September United Nations General Assembly meeting, I think is kind of very much indicative that I feel that the Palestine movement is on the up in a way, in terms of applying kind of real kind of political pressure on the Albanese government. And so I think within the Palestine movement, this is something we should take stock in. I mean, that's not giving any kind of defence to the Labor government. And I think it's all well and good that people should be rightfully cynical about the Labor decision to recognise Palestine. I mean, it's clear that they're very much trying to give a bit of a fig leaf to, because, you know, following the Harbour Bridge protests, it actually followed up with, okay, we're going to give X amount of aid to Israel Palestine, and then clearly that wasn't good enough, like in terms of the kind of political kind of response, and then they followed up with, okay, well, we're gonna support recognition of Palestine, and I think there's a sort of contradiction that this opens up for Labor. So, you know, at the end of the day, if you recognise Palestine as a state, you know, as a state that has a right to levels of self-determination and a right to kind of exist. I mean, what is your actual attitude and what is your position in terms of the fact that a much more powerful state is bombing, starving, and destroying it, and you're not acting on that? I mean, doesn't that in a sense make you complicit? So I think there's a certain element where, with the loss of support that Israel is facing globally, the Albanese government and other Western governments are, you know, they're very much trying to figure out if they can engage in some kind of, you know, face-saving exercise to save Israel from itself in reality. So I think there's, and I also think a few things, another thing that has to be kind of said about this in terms of the recognition of Palestine. I mean, we kind of don't really talk about this enough, but I mean, this should probably be something that we should talk about in a future program. But I think it's pretty disgraceful that, you know, a number of the neighboring Arab nations are basically complicit in supporting this whole, you know, demilitarization of Palestine, all these sort of conditionalities. They're essentially collaborating with the West, and, you know, openly kind of support, openly giving political cover to Israel. And I think that complicity must be called out, especially since the masses of people within the Middle East are ultimately stand with Palestine. But these elected leaders do not represent the interest of people in Egypt, Jordan and Saudi Arabia and so on. Yeah, I just think it's quite outrageous, the kind of level of complicity that is coming behind behind the sort of Arab, behind the leaders of the Arab nations. I also will probably say a few things. I mean, there's a good article in Green Left that's written by Palestinian Australian Khalid Ghanem, and he makes a number of, I think, important kind of points about this whole recognition of Palestine. He thinks that, you know, there's this clear kind of contradiction about, you know, they say that when it comes to a hypothetical future Palestinian state, they insist on the need for free and fair elections, including presidential parliamentary elections, all fair and good. But then he points the question, how can there be such an election in which a major political movement such as Hamas, which has at least 35% support, is excluded? And then there's this question of, well, why is this whole boogeyman of Hamas? I mean, you can kind of see it from the kind of right-wing sort of commentary. Why are they sort of just, it's just accepted in the mainstream that they're just unquestionably a terrorist organization. And I was actually struck by the comments that that Tony Burke made the other day. He made it before this announcement was made. He pointed out that there is a precedent for states to be recognized even if they are under quote-unquote terrorist occupation. But many people who, when they read the headline of that, they thought that he was referring to Israel, but no, he was actually referring to Hamas. And it's completely outrageous when you consider the level of horrors that Israel has unleashed to the population. It actually almost doesn't even register in these Western governments. So despite all the fact that the Albanese government will talk about things like, oh, you know, what Israel is doing is unconscionable in terms of denying aid to a starving population, you know, when you look at the language, when you look at the way that they talk about Palestine, they're ultimately coming from a pro-Israel line that bases its support on their so-called argument that Israel represents a democratic state. And I also think that these conditions that they're imposing on the hypothetical Palestinian state shows that they really do not have any respect or any real support for Palestinian self-determination. In a sense, these Western powers just expect Palestinians should just get small amount of crumbs after, you know, experiencing one of the most horrifying genocide, which they're still experiencing, and they just have to kind of put up with it. And I think that's just outrageous in a lot of ways. And I think that's why I think it's going to be very important to, you know, mobilise as many people as possible for August 24, and especially think it's a great thing. I mean, coming from Australian Union public discussion organised by Free Palestine Melbourne yesterday, a number of Australian Unions have come out in support of August 24th. So I think we've got to keep that kind of mobilisation up. I think we want to make it a big protest.
And also, what about the condition that Israel's, you know, recognizing that Israel has a right to exist? I think that's one of the conditions as well. And this claim that supporters of Israel has, it's completely illogical and outrageous, because states don't have rights, people have rights. Both Palestinians and Israelis should have rights. And the insistence that Israel's right to exist is a demand that is a demand for a supremacist Jewish state in which Palestinians are considered second-class citizens. And it actually makes Israel an apartheid state. So it's, you know, we just need to remember, and I think we're not trying to convince our listeners, because we know you're already convinced, but the existence of Palestinian people, they're the ones that are under threat, not Israel. And these conditions attached to this Palestinian statehood thing is, it's probably made lots of people angry. But yeah, agree, Jacob, that it also has come out of, it is a response to the success of the global solidarity movement for Palestine. And yeah, it's just important to keep marching, keep raising our voices, you know, and keep raising our voices that oppressed people should have the right to fight back. And yeah, keep going to the weekly rallies every Sunday, 12 o'clock at the State Library. We meet, we hear speeches from all different kinds of people, and then we march to a different place almost every Sunday. All right, we're going to go to a quick break and then we'll come back with more Green Left Radio.
3CR. Always bringing you the latest union news.
They're coming after us at the moment. They want to get rid of penalty rates, the big push from businesses. They want to get rid of all the things that you and I have fought for.
So there's tens of thousands of jobs gone, contracted out to sham contracting arrangements.
On 8.55 a.m. and on the web, 3cr.org.au.
We're going to go to a song, The Firing Line by Les Thomas. It's a powerful protest song. It's a new one, and it gives voice to civilians, especially children caught in the devastation of this genocide. And we hope listeners enjoy, probably for the first time.
Out there on the firing line, see the faces left behind. Hiroshima by the day, torn and scattered where they lay on the firing line. Never again is what they said. Now I wonder what they meant. Did they speak for all of us? Lives unequal, gold or dust on the firing line. Pressure cooker, open jail, trigger fingers sure to fail. In the incubation room, born into a world of doom on the firing line. There's no reason, no excuse, and no accepting their abuse. No time for complicity, but they've every reason to be free on the firing line. Justice turns to you.
Turns to
what will you tell your own child? What's left of the meek and mild on the firing line? Don't be silent, please be brave. the firing
are back listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and you just heard award-winning singer-songwriter Les Thomas's powerful new single, "The Firing Line." It's an anti-genocide song, and we really also want to promote the launch of the single, which is going to be at the John Curtin Hotel on Sunday, August 31st. And he's going to be singing with ARIA award winner Kavisha Mazzella. So it's a special event, and they're raising funds for urgent humanitarian aid in Gaza. So we hope to see you there. We're going to now play an interview that was done by Isaac Nellist, who is a Green Left editor. Isaac recently spoke to Amanda Shweta Lui, who is from the Socialist Party of Malaysia, about the commercialization of Malaysia's education system. And in solidarity, she's also speaking out in solidarity with Palestine and why young Malaysians are looking to socialism. Hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Green Left Show. My name is Isaac Nellist, and today I'm going to be talking to Amanda Shweta Lewis from the Socialist Party of Malaysia, or PSM. Now, Amanda is also coordinates the party's West Papua Working Group. She's a chairperson of the youth wing of the PSM, and is also a central committee member of GIGA America, which opposes US imperialism in the global south, and is currently focused on the liberation of Palestine. Now, it's very exciting because Amanda is actually coming to Australia for the Eco-Socialism 2025 conference, Eco-Socialism, Not Barbarism, which is taking place in NAM, Melbourne, on the September 5th to the 7th in Brunswick at a venue called Balam Place. So if you're interested in what you hear today in this chat and you want to find out more, make sure you get your tickets to Eco-Socialism at ecosocialism.org.au. She's going to be speaking on two panels, one on Prabowo's Indonesia and the struggle for West Papuan self-determination, and the other on rebuilding socialist politics in Southeast Asia. So that's very exciting, and Amanda's one of many guests who are coming from the Asia-Pacific region and other parts of the world to the conference. It's going to be a really fun weekend and very interesting, I think. So yeah, check out the full agenda, list of speakers at the Eco-Socialism website, ecosocialism.org.au. Also, just before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge that I'm speaking from stolen land, land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and this land was never ceded, and it always was, always will be, Aboriginal land. And Green Left pledges to stand with First Nations people in campaigns for justice, sovereignty, and land rights. Also mention, if you like this episode today and you want to find out more about Green Left, you can get to greenleft.org.au and become a supporter from just $5 a month to help keep this project going. It's the easiest way to both get our content and to support us. And we're also in the middle of a supporter drive at the moment. So we've got a supporter drive live stream coming up on the 16th of August from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Where there'll be a lot of guests tuning in to plug why they think Green Left is important and also talk about the campaigns they're involved in. So you can find that a live stream link on the Green Left YouTube or on our events calendar. So now that I've gotten all of that out of the way, thanks for joining me, Amanda. Welcome to the Green Left Show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So I guess to get started, as I mentioned, you know, you're involved in the youth wing of PSM, and I've been working with student groups as well. So I was just wondering if you could tell us about the current situation for young people and students in Malaysia.
Sure. The situation for students in Malaysia is a bit challenging, I would say, because our system is split into two. We have the public university stream and also private universities, and both have their shortcomings. You see, the last public university was built in the year 2007. This is almost 18 years ago. And I think it's quite a common theme we see in capitalist-led countries where public universities are limited in number and capacity, which then makes entry extremely competitive. And this could also be due to a variety of reasons, but specifically in the Malaysian context, I would say that the existence of the Bumiputra quota that we have. Now, Bumiputra refers to the Malays and the indigenous people. This quota actually dates back to the 1970s, when the government at that time implemented policies designed to favor Bumiputra, which included affirmative action in public education in order to elevate their socioeconomic status. And this effort was actually used to diffuse inter-ethnic tensions following the 13 May incident and to placate the Malay majority through granting them a privileged status over the Malaysian Chinese and Indians. Now, this was originally intended as a temporary measure, but these policies are still in effect. And in 2002, the government actually abolished race-based admissions to public universities. However, this quota system actually remains in some of the matriculation colleges with a 90% quota for Bumiputras, while certain foundation courses are exclusively for Bumiputras. And the issue then comes when public universities can't accommodate everyone. It sort of shows that the government has essentially stepped back from their responsibility of providing free, accessible education to all, you know? And this then opens the floodgates to the private sector. So in Malaysia in 1996, the Private Higher Educational Institution Act was established, and this is where we saw a mushrooming of private universities in our country. And this has also led the race-based right-wing political parties in Malaysia to seize that opportunity to establish their own educational institutions as a form of maintaining their political hegemony. And we know that private education can be very expensive. Many young people, they graduate with debt, you know. And in Malaysia, we have this student loan system called the PTPTN, which I see as a state-sanctioned debt trap. And just in 2025, May of 2025, our Prime Minister, Anwar, he did say that the government is considering to review these loan rates just to aid borrowers while addressing the issue of the high outstanding debts. Repayment rates are also burdensome, especially given that starting salaries for graduate remain low and job opportunities that match their skills are quite limited. The minimum wage in Malaysia is only 1,700 ringgit, which is not that high. Yeah. And just to share a bit of a personal story, like my own mother had to use her retirement funds for my education after I was not able to gain access into the public university stream. And I feel like this is quite the reality for a thousand of Malaysians out there. And our education system is quite a brutal engine of neoliberal exploitation. And I like to brand that as the cycle of violence, because you pay so much for education, you graduate into the current market that is just so terrible, and then you carry this debt with you. Then you get a job that you don't really like, and then you're living in like alienation or just in a hopeless world. Yeah,
it sounds, we have similar issues in Australia where, with the kind of neoliberalization of the university system, where it becomes about, you know, producing, you know, workers so that companies can profit, and similar issues around people graduating with high amounts of debt and debt that they can never really pay off. I mean, our government just cut student debt by 20%, which sounds like it's a good kind of small step, but it's that the debt has been increasing through over the years by more than that 20%. So it's kind of, not not enough. I guess I was just wondering, under this kind of current conditions that students are facing, is the Malaysian government currently doing anything to address this? You touched on it a little bit, but just expand on that.
Yeah, surprisingly, over the past decade, the government has actually been cutting back on how much they spend on public universities. You see, back in the 2010s, higher education got about 6 to 8% of the national budget. And now it's closer to about 4% just last year. And what this means is that on the ground, the universities, these public universities, they are being told to make do with less. And I feel like this shrinking public investment shows a clear gap, especially for the Madani government that we currently have in Malaysia, and their reformist rhetoric that they always throw out, because they are not providing the actual affordable and quality access to higher education like they have promised. And this is, as usual, a part of the broader trend of the neoliberal restructuring that we see, where the cost of education is shifted from the government or the state and is pushed onto the individual and also their families. Yeah. And in Malaysia, we did have the creation of the Ministry of Higher Education only in the year 2004. And this was meant to strengthen the sector. But what has happened is that it has become a tool for politicians because they have more, control over how universities function. Because ministers now have the opportunity to appoint their cronies to become vice chancellors at the top, making it impossible for universities to be independent, I would say. And just to quote some research by New Mandala, they have confirmed that these lofty promises of the National Higher Education Blueprint are often undermined by stagnant funding and outdated financial models. Performance-based funding now rewards short-term metrics like publication counts and graduate employability, rather than long-term goals such as academic excellence, critical thinking, and socially impactful research, which is what we are all lacking in right now.
I guess I was wondering as well how, if there's any kind of resistance to this by students, and I guess also from university workers and educators as well, if you could talk about that resistance.
Yeah, currently from my observations, there are no strong student movements that are directly challenging the commodification of higher education in Malaysia. And I would say that there are a few student groups that are organized, but their focus tends to extend beyond educational issues. Some of them engage with broader struggles for democratic rights. For example, some groups have been active in the opposition of the legislative changes in the right to peaceful assemblies in Malaysia. However, the PSM, the Socialist Party of Malaysia, we have been a consistent voice advocating for a fundamental solution, free public education. We've seen education as a fundamental human right, essential for individual development, meaningful societal contribution, and also in improving socioeconomic conditions. Education should not be a commodity. And in Malaysia, to achieve this, it would require a major expansion of the public education infrastructure. This means that building more public universities, colleges, and institutions to increase capacity. And perhaps a crucial first step to be taken is that the government can take over some of these troubled private institutions. And this expansion would then directly address the root cause, because you already have these buildings available. So you could just, you have that space, you know, so you can allow access for education to more students. And ultimately, free education would significantly ease the economic burden on young people that are facing the rising costs of living.
Yeah, that sounds like a really important campaign to be involved in as the PSM. Good luck to that and keep pushing for that. Just to, shift topic slightly, the biggest movement that's been going on, at least in Australia, but also around the world over the past 2 years, has been the Palestine Solidarity Movement, obviously with the genocide that's been going on in Gaza as well as, you know, the attacks in the occupied West Bank. And it's really starting to reach kind of a bigger point here in Australia. We just had a really big march across the Sydney Harbour Bridge, which you might have seen. The Labor government's responded by recognizing Palestinian statehood, which, you know, as people have pointed out online, is a symbolic gesture that doesn't do anything really to stop the genocide, but it reflects, you know, the pressure that they're under from this big movement. And Malaysia is in a very different position as a country that has supported Palestine historically. But as the genocide has escalated, how has the Malaysian government responded? And could you tell us about the kind of the grassroots movement for Palestine as well?
Yeah, you are right when you said that Malaysia has maintained this long-standing vocal diplomatic position in support of Palestine. And I think the current government has intensified its rhetoric in issuing a lot of strong condemnations of the displacement of the genocide and also calling for decisive international action against Israel and also the United States. But these official statements serve important roles in the diplomatic channels. But I also feel that the effectiveness and sincerity of the government is being undermined when you look at how we are having concurrent military engagements. Because recently, actually last year, Malaysia was involved in the RIMPAC, the Rim of the Pacific exercise, which is the world's largest international maritime warfare exercise, which is just jarring to me. And like Israel participated in this. So it's like you're doing in the front, you're showing that you're so pro-Palestine, but in the back, you're like shaking hands with all these dirty people. Like, just doesn't make sense. And even recently, just last month, we had a military training collaboration with the United States and the Australian imperialist powers through the Kerris Strike exercise, which was said that it was needed under the guise of improving regional security. So we don't know what that means, but it still happened. And this contradiction that Malaysia is in, it puts us in a position where what we're saying just becomes not credible. Condemning words is important, but without real action, like imposing sanctions or kicking out the US embassy, it words just feel empty. And I think for as long as we continue to cooperate with all these military powers, we are not really doing anything. And it shows that, oh, these strategic relationships or partnerships are more important than the genocide happening right now. So it's just heartbreaking that this is the reality that we live in. And just to talk about the grassroots movement, maybe specifically, I'd like to highlight Gagar. And Gagar, we have, it's sort of considered a front of the PSM. We have been quite active in street actions, teach-ins. We have organized a few protests out of the US Embassy. And the funny thing is, you would think that for a nation that seems so pro-Palestine, at two of these protests, we've had one comrade get arrested. And at another protest, we had two comrades get called in for questioning, which is just why we are all here for the same cause. We want a free Palestine. But yet, the police, or I don't know if it's under the power of the US Embassy, who's directing them to conduct all these police investigations. But yeah, that's the reality here.
Yeah, it's a similar thing where, I mean, Australia has been very much pro-Israel as an imperialist kind of power, especially in this region. And you know, but they will talk about how we don't like seeing the suffering and innocent people being killed and things like that. But then, yeah, sounds are similar where they will say that, but they won't actually do anything meaningful to address it and actively still. I mean, we're still sending weapons parts to Israel, have deals with Israeli weapons companies, etc. So, but it's good to know that there's groups that are, you know, protesting. I guess especially the US imperialism connection, which is obviously a major part of why this is happening as well. I guess to go to a bit of a more positive note, there's been a bit of a rise in kind of young people in particular looking towards socialism or at least socialist ideas as the, you know, the solution to a lot of these issues like climate destruction, war, the cost of living and housing and things like that. So what's, is this phenomenon also taking place in Malaysia, and why do you think that is?
Yeah, absolutely, it's happening here. And this is because young Malaysians are just waking up to the harsh truth, you know, capitalism sucks. It's destroying our future, especially when you see you graduate with debt, your paycheck is being used on rent. And yep, the climate crisis is just overwhelming and also worsening. And at the same time, you see all these politicians with corporations shaking their dirty hands. This just means that turning left becomes the only viable option. And why this shift is important is that when we understand that the system is rigged because we work so hard, all of this for what? For profit to get prioritized and our planet is burning. Another thing for students or young people in Malaysia is that I really feel that we are starved of community. You know, we have really lost third spaces in Malaysia. We need to see more third spaces, because what's happening now is they are building all these shopping complexes, especially in like the cities, and every third space that they create sort of demands you to buy something, you know? There's no like third space that's just free or open. We are seeing less and less parks, and it just sucks, because why does it mean that living under capitalism means there's no need for a public space that is not profitable? And that's why in the socialist youth of PSM, Pemuda Socialists, our numbers are surging up. We can be considered a vital force of the PSM, and we make up nearly 20% of the party. I feel that what's critical for those who are unsure of what to do when life under capitalism gets too overwhelming, we need to use this energy that fills us to be organized under socialist principles. Now, we must understand that capitalism thrives by dividing struggles. We have climate activists working separately, workers over here mobilizing themselves, students over there doing their own thing. But fighting in isolation is what capitalism wants. And it makes the movement easier to crush. And socialism provides this framework for us to unite all of these struggles, because at the end of the day, we have to understand that all of our struggles are interconnected when we are fighting the same system. And when people want to turn to liberalism, they must understand that it only offers reforms that just touch the issues here and there. It's not getting to the root cause. And if you want to pander to the right, it's just worse and it's hopeless, because the right, they redirect all their rage to migrants, to the poor, and they continue to protect the elites, the people who actually caused the crisis. And there's a lot of anger and frustration among the youth, but this needs proper direction. Without a clear ideology, this energy, I feel, sort of risks being misdirected or even co-opted by certain groups. And socialist principles provide the analysis and the strategic focus for collective action aimed at fundamental change. That's why PSM's socialist framework is vital. We connect the dots, we unite the struggle into one fight against the core of the capitalist system. And that is also why the correct ideology matters. And when nothing goes right, go left.
That's a great point to end on. And I think it's very important that, yeah, all these struggles can unite together to resist capitalism. And I think as well, it points to, again, I'll plug the upcoming Eco-Socialism Conference, where we also need to unite internationally, and especially within our region, the Asia-Pacific region, which is why I think it's great that we've got yourself and another representative from PSM attending the conference, as well as, socialist activists from Singapore, from Indonesia, from South Korea, from Philippines. It's going to be a great kind of convergence of all of these of activists, and we can all kind of learn from each other and discuss the kind of issues that we're facing. So I would encourage people, if you want to come and talk, hear from Amanda more and talk about these struggles more, to come to the conference at ecosocialism.org.au. Is there anything you'd like to add before we finish up?
I'm just super excited to be there, and I can't wait to meet you all and hear these important conversations happen. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much to Amanda, and I hope that everyone listening found this interesting and engaging. And as I said at the beginning, if you'd like to support Green Left, head to greenleft.org.au/support, and plans start from just $5 a month. And we'll see you on the next episode of The Green Left Show. Thanks for watching.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And for the next part of our program, I want to cover a few news stories from the pages of Green Left, but also some other media like People's Dispatch, covering some of the kind of latest kind of political developments that have been happening. Now, in other news, I wanted to kind of draw on this kind of report that I'm coming from all the way in Pilbara. Chris Jenkins writes that the MUA gears up for a Pilbara strike over wages and housing. And so basically there is a dispute that the Maritime Union of Australia has with the Pilbara Port Authority, and it's applied for protected industrial action on July 25th at the Utah Port Bulk Handling Facility in Port Hedland, Western Australia. Now, this proposed strike action comes after the PPA refused mediation through the Fair Work Commission on the union's claims around wages of housing. And negotiations have essentially began on a new enterprise bargaining agreement with the PPA last November, and the MUA is seeking to overturn the two-track wages system, which allows the PPA to pay workers recruited after 2017 $30,000 to $40,000 a year less than those employed earlier doing the same work. And the MUA is also seeking a housing allowance in the enterprise agreement, as well as workers face dire housing shortages across the Pilbara. And of course, the PPA claims it has to abide by WA Labor's public sector wages policy, which restricts wage rises to 3% a year. The MUA said this should not extend to highly profitable enterprises such as the PPA. They reported that in our meetings, we continue to see the Pilbara Port Authority blame the WA state government for an inability to reach agreement. MUA Northwest organiser Joel O'Brien said on July 28th, they cry poor in negotiation meetings with union and say the complete opposite to the state government during recent state budget submissions. O'Brien reported that the PPA recorded 775.7 million tonnes of exports and imports over 2024, totaling $153 billion worth of commodities across the four ports. Its net profit after tax was $246 million. So really, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, the PPA is refusing to negotiate, and the MUA has reported that it's announced its intention to strike. The PPA has offered, you know, to include company-supplied housing and housing alliances into the enterprise bargain, but is refusing to budge on the union's wage demand. So the MUA is continuing to prepare to strike. However, given the PPA's refusal to negotiate in good faith, similar action is also expected at the Eastern Harbour in Port Hedland and the Amper Cargo Wharf. So yeah, that's just a bit of a sample of some industrial dispute that's happening in Western Australia. Now, going a bit more internationally, I guess I wanted to kind of talk a bit about this drawing a report from last week and that was published in the People's Dispatch. But right now there is, this is quite inspiring in a lot of ways. And I guess many, some of our listeners are kind of aware that the Direct Action Group in Britain, Palestine Action Group, has basically been proscribed as a terrorist group. And now there's essentially a series of protests that are starting to be kind of organised, peaceful protests, which are basically opposing this prescription. But yeah, of course, what you're seeing is now the kind of this is quite amusing in a kind of bizarre way, and kind of is very revealing of these Western capitalist countries and their so-called commitment to democratic values. You know, we're seeing that there's reports of since Palestine Action was banned at the beginning of July, you know, police are basically arresting dozens of people, including health workers, pensioners and students, just for holding cardboard signs reading "I oppose genocide, I support Palestine Action." In multiple cases, we're also seeing the police raiding the homes of those arrested, according to collectives such as Defend Our Juries and We Do Not Comply. While some police forces avoid making arrests, others, including in London, pursued a significantly more aggressive kind of strategy. And of course, the repression escalated ahead of the August 9 protests. Defend Our Juries reported that its website, which hosted legal advice and information participants, was taken down without notice. Scheduled online briefings were also removed. Make no mistake, this is the fault of the UK government and their use of anti-terror laws to silence opposition, the group said. So yeah, that's just a bit of an update on some of the developments that are sort of happening there. And I guess the last kind of news article I kind of want to report on is we've just published a recent article in Green Left about this scathing report of RoboDep 2.0. So this was a report commissioned by the Commonwealth Ombudsman, and it's found that nearly 1,000 job seeker recipients have had their payments unlawfully cancelled over a 2-year period in what welfare advocates have dubbed RoboDep 2.0. So essentially what was sort of happening, we're now in this situation where people are getting their Centrelink payments just automatically cut automatically between April, which happened between April, July 22nd and July 2024, which is due to an IT error with the targeted compliance framework, a system set up under the coalition government. And just to tell you a bit more about this targeted compliance framework system, you know, the TCF monitors job seekers and ensures mutual obligations, attending job provider appointments and actively searching for work are met. If they are not, it can penalise job seekers via reduced, suspended or cancelled payments. Following the RoboDep scandal in 2022, new laws were introduced to ensure that job seekers would not be subjected to harsh automated payment charges or cancellations without human oversight to understand a job seeker's circumstances. Anderson found that this did not happen in the 964 cases, and that the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations in Services Australia failed to take adequate steps to ensure that the TCF was implemented in accordance with the 2022 amendment. It is said that this likely had a catastrophic impact on vulnerable job seekers. This is just a really... it's a very kind of terrible kind of thing that this is still happening. RoboDep was kind of bad enough one of our listeners would be aware, Zane Alcorn had a very kind of direct presenter. Zane Alcorn had a very direct experience with RoboDep. And I just think that this sort of bureaucratic kind of welfare systems attached to the welfare state, I think, are just very much outrageous. And it's not just payments being automatically kind of cancelled. You know, there's a lot people who are on Centrelink just face these very horrible kind of punitive kind of measures to kind of prove that they deserve to kind of stay on welfare payments. But yeah, Chloe, did you sort of have any comments on anything to add?
No, I think you covered it pretty well. And I just wanted to play a song before we go to our next interview. Or is it the Activist Calendar next?
Yes, we'll go for the Activist Calendar next.
Oh, shoot. Maybe we'll do them both, I don't know. Hey, we're in the middle of a revolution, because I see the face of things to come. Yes, I do. Oh, your constitution, well, my friend, it's gonna have to bend.
about the destruction of all the evil it will have to end.
That was Nina Simone, Revolution.
Okay, so now, I mean, we're 2 minutes a bit early, but there's quite a lot of events to kind of promote. So it is now time for the Green Left Activist Calendar. So I wanted to highlight some of the events that's going to be kind of happening. So on Saturday, August the 16th, there's going to be a counter-protest, Don't Let Fascists Speak, and that's going to be happening at 11:30 a.m. at the Parliament of Victoria in Spring Street in the city. This is a protest, counter-protest that's been called in response to a very kind of a transphobic protest that's been organised by the far right. So I think, yeah, it would be an important kind of counter-protest to go to. And also, I guess the one thing to kind of add to that, there is, just to make listeners aware, there is the far right have called for a protest on August 31st, like this sort of Take Back Australia kind of, I don't know what the protest is really But it's basically a white nationalist protest that's been called, and they're trying to actually undercut the Palestine protest. So they've actually called a protest for the for Sunday, 31st August at 11 a.m., 1 hour before the Palestine rally is supposed to start. So, yeah, we're going to have to... there's going to be a counter protest, I think, or some kind of protest that's been called at 10 a.m. And I think that'll be kind of important to mobilise. Other things to kind of add, on Saturday, August the 16th, there'll be the
Green
live stream.
Green Left is going live.
Yeah, Power and Rebellion. And you can view that online, but you can also join with other supporters of Green Left at the Resistance Centre, level 5407 Swanson Street in the city. And then on Sunday, August the 17th, there's going to be an exhibition, Viva Cuba, Paintings of Cuba, 2 p.m. at the Sisters of Mercy Studio, 617/618 Nicholson Street in Fitzroy North. Then on Monday, August 18th, there's going to be a community conversation, Cafe Palestine at 7 p.m. at the Azim Isma Cafe, 307/311 Sydney Road in Brunswick. On Tuesday, August the 19th, there's going to be a book launch, Absolute Ethical Life, Aristotle, Hegel and Marx, at 7:30 p.m. at the Alderman in Brunswick East. Then on Saturday, August the 23rd, there's going to be a protest, a picket, Boycott Caltex, at 10 a.m. at 711 Moray Road in Preston. There'll also be a film screening, Gaza, Doctors Under Attack, 1 p.m. at the Box Hill Library. And then there'll be another film screening of Palestinians Don't Need Sideworks, plus after film discussion at 4 p.m. at the FOMO Cinemas at 15 Bluestone, Brunswick East. Then on Sunday, August the 24th, there will be the nationwide rally march for Palestine at 12 p.m. at the State Library. And I've also been informed there's going to be a gathering for trade unionists from 11 a.m. at the Trades Hall. And then on Sunday, August the 31st, there's going to be a fundraiser, The Firing Line, with music by Les Thomas and Kavish Mazella at 3 p.m. at the Curtain, 29 Lygon Street in Carlton. Just a few events sort of printing here. And then more importantly, there's going to be a concert for Palestine, music by Mats Edens at 5:54 p.m. 4 Covert Street in Heidelberg West. And then September 5th to the September 7th, there's going to be the Eco-Socialism 20 Conference, Eco-Socialism Not Barbarism at Ballinballin Place, 15 Phoenix Street in Brunswick. And then on Monday, September the 18th, there's going to be a public forum, Australia Don't Just Criticise Cruel Regimes, Start Welcoming Their Refugees, and they'll be happening at 6:30 p.m. at the Kathleen Syme Library at 2251 Faraday Street in Carlton. And then on Tuesday, September the 9th, there's going to be a book talk with Randa Abdel Fattah, Discipline, 6 p.m. at the Wheeler Centre. And then on Thursday, October the 23rd, there's going to be a public meeting around protecting public housing. And then the last thing I point out is the keep your dates booked for Thursday, November the 27th to Tuesday, December the 2nd. Rising Tide, join the NAM contingent for the people's blockade of the world's largest coal port. So that'll be happening at the Horseshoes Beach at Newcastle. But yeah, are there any other sort of events that I've sort of missed?
Well, you can get in touch with us and let us know, because we can always add it to the Green Left activist calendar that goes out on a fortnightly basis. Or you can head to greenleft.org.au/events and check out everything that we've listed. Get in touch with us if you think we've missed something. We'll be back with more Green Left just after this ad.
Capitalism's inherent barbarism is on full display, from the genocide in Gaza and the rise of the far right, to growing militarism and the climate crisis.
We need to radically change the way society is organised.
Join us for the upcoming Eco-Socialism 2025 conference, Eco-Socialism, Not Barbarism, held on September 5th to the 7th at the Ballinballin Place in Brunswick.
We will be bringing together activists from across the Indo-Pacific, sharing experiences to resist capitalism's drive to barbarism and build the mass movements that we need.
Anyone who wants to be part of the discussion on how we can build a left-wing alternative is welcome to attend.
Featuring international guests from the United States, Pakistan, India, Malaysia, and Brazil, along with local campaigners.
Organised by Green Left and Socialist Alliance. Find out more by going to ecosocialism.org.au.
Green Left is a 3CR supporter.
Stumble to the kitchen, I pour myself a cup of ambition. I yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Then I jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5. To watch him shatter, you're just a step on the boss man's ladder, but you got dreams he'll never take away. And you're in the same boat with a lot of your friends, waiting for the day your ship will come in. The tide's gonna turn and it's all gonna roll your way. I just met working 9 to 5.
You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And we're very happy to be joined by Caroline Smith, who is one of the media spokesperson for the global movement to Gaza. And she's also based in Boolaroo in Western Australia. And we have her live on the program to kind of talk about the whole the organisation of the Flotilla Coalition to break that is attempting to kind of break the siege on Gaza. So good morning, Caroline.
Good morning, Jacob. How are you going?
Yeah, I'm good. So maybe to kind of start off, what can you tell us about the Freedom Flotilla that the global movement for Gaza to Gaza has is part of, and also how is Australia and New Zealand mobilising to be part of it?
Sure. So let me begin by saying that the group that I'm with, which is the Global March to Gaza, it's actually not part of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition or the FFC, but we're working alongside them. Underneath a sort of parent company, which is called the Global Samud Flotilla. And the Global Samud Flotilla is basically organising this whole journey to Gaza, and it's bringing together three different organisations, one of them being the FFC, one of them being the Global Movement to Gaza, which actually emerged out of the Global March to Gaza in June this year. And I was part of that as well. And then there was also the Samud convoy, which was a bit like the Global March to Gaza. It was basically trying to break the siege by land through basically a journey to Gaza to deliver aid. So essentially the Global Samud Flotilla has sort of brought together these three organizations who have different origins, different history, but all have been attempting to break the siege, two of them by land and one of them, of course, by sea. With the FFC, they've got quite a proud history, going all the way back to 2010, of trying to break the siege through boat journeys to Gaza, responding essentially to the blockade that was placed on the Gaza Strip in 2007. But they've sort of they've emerged out of attempts to break the siege by sea, and you know they themselves have taken a number of really heroic journeys since 2010 in particular, and were essentially inspired by that to do something similar.
And what can you tell? Because I think what you're kind of part of is obviously part of quite a long kind of history of different kind of actions. And can you tell us a bit, give a bit more of a kind of background of some of these kind of past actions that have kind of attempted to kind of break Israel's sort of siege?
Yep. So basically, Israel sort of maintained a blockade on the Gaza Strip since 2007, and that's been condemned by multiple human rights organizations as a collective punishment on the population. It's meant that people haven't had enough food, water, electricity, medical care, and in fact, it was declared a crime against humanity by the UN Special Rapporteur Richard Falk in 2008. So this is really that's the sort of context. But we've had multiple different attempts to break the siege by sea. And starting in 2010, we had the Freedom Flotilla Coalition attempting that. And actually, there was their first Freedom Flotilla boat set off in 2010. And of course, there was a horrific response by the Israeli authorities. They actually killed 9 activists. And this did actually get a backlash in terms of the international community. So after that, you know, a little bit more food and aid was allowed into the territory. But there have been a number of different attempts since then, and, you know, with varying levels of success. But, of course, this year we've had, we've had a number of different attempts, particularly the high-profile ones like the Madeleine, which was with the FFC. It tried to journey in June this year, and then the Handala in July the next month. So, and that's obviously responding to the fact that there's a much more serious situation now, whereby the starvation is reaching sort of catastrophic levels within this genocide.
And there's been a number of flotillas that have attempted to kind of break Israel's siege, including the one that was that involved, you know, prominent figures such as Greta kind of Thunberg. And can you tell us a bit about, you know, how has the kind of broader international community responded to these actions that have attempted to kind of break the siege, including Israel's kind of response? Because I think, you know, there's been quite, you know, Israel's kind of response has been quite disgraceful, especially in terms of how they've treated, these peaceful kind of protesters.
Yeah, look, absolutely. It's actually quite interesting that, as I said, you know, this year we've had these two really high-profile attempts to break the siege with the Madeleine and the Handala. And, you know, I think the public response has been really positive. We've seen that the, you know, it's been all over the news. And, I mean, obviously, with the Madeleine, Greta Thunberg being on board was, I think, a way of gaining that attention, and I think it worked. Certainly, we've had, you know, we've had a lot of support. I think a lot of people have essentially not only been tuning in to watch what's happening, and this is the thing that I noticed with the Madeleine in particular, people were actually on social media commenting on this. There was a real raising of attention. People were sort of keeping all eyes on the Madeleine and the Handala later on as well. And that sort of repeated or echoed the, you know, the statement, all eyes on Gaza as well. But people were watching what was happening and were, I think, pretty horrified whenever the, you know, these boats were both intercepted by Israel. So, I mean, we've definitely seen that there's been pretty horrific treatment of these activists. I mean, you know, obviously some of them have been able to go home pretty quickly, but, you know, the Israelis have made horrific statements about them, and then they've also just You know, they've been accused of mistreating the activists, including some, you know, attacks that appear to be racially motivated as well. You know, it's, I think that they've actually, they've done nothing for their reputation in doing this, in actually abusing the activists who've actually been picked up. And it's, I think the other thing is it's been very, very clear that this has happened in international waters. The interception has happened in international waters. So essentially there's, you know, they haven't really been able to claim that this is in any way legitimate. You know, they've picked up activists, they've taken them to, they've incarcerated them, and then essentially these people have been able to tell their story about what's happened.
Hmm. And can you, you wrote for Green Left about that you're part of a kind of protest to kind of break the siege in Egypt. And I guess, what did you, can you share anything about that particular experience, especially as it relates to a lot of the, to the current campaign that's kind of happening?
Yeah. Okay. So basically, the global march to Gaza, I think, really was it indicated the extent to which this situation is really desperate, because you know we've seen this sort of total siege that and blockade which began in March, and you know really it was very, very clear that people were going to starve to death. And at this point, we've seen that I think it's 239 people, according to Al Jazeera, have starved to death. Just that's been reported as of yesterday, including 106 children. So there was, I think, a desperate mood among activists that they needed to do something. And of course, as I said, you know, these flotillas had been organized by the FFC as well, but then there was this. This new movement that came about, organized by Palestinian people in diaspora, which sought to break the siege by land as well, and essentially it was taking activists to Egypt, where they would march to the Rafah border town, and the plan was to negotiate with Egyptian authorities to allow a little bit of aid to get through, and basically breaking the siege. But as we saw, I mean, people who were watching this, it was very clear that the Egyptian authorities' response to the activists who turned up in Cairo was pretty horrific. People did manage to begin the journey and went through several blockades, several checkpoints, but were received a response from the Egyptian authorities, which essentially included violence and many people were deported as well, and there were reports of abuse in detention before they were deported. So essentially the Egyptian authorities didn't allow us to get through the checkpoints and to make it to Rafah. So I think we can say to some extent the movement was not successful, but it was successful in raising the attention of the world to the fact that ordinary people were really desperate to actually to stop this blockade and to actually help get aid through, and also obviously I think people became aware of the contribution that other countries such as Egypt, or at least the authorities there, were playing in preventing this from happening. So I think, you know, in terms of the attention of the world, it actually was successful, and we're sort of using that to build on and essentially to progress with this next campaign to get aid to the people.
Thanks you very much, Caroline. I guess, do you kind of have any final comments, but also how our listeners can follow and give solidarity to kind of like the work that you're doing and are part of?
Okay, so the main thing is, I think, to follow us on social media. We have, I'm actually part of the Global Movement to Gaza, the Australia, New Zealand, or Aotearoa delegation. And we have an Instagram account, which you can follow. And basically, we're going to be posting as much as we can about what's planned on this. And essentially, the plan is that in the next month, we will be heading off. So if you want to follow us, keep an eye on what we're doing. And we also are looking for, I guess, financial support as well to actually get our activists over to Europe so that they can participate in this. But I think the key thing will be once we actually set off, we will want people to keep an eye on the flotilla boats, because it's really people being aware of what we're doing and also keeping their eyes on Gaza as well that is really going to enable us to have hopefully a successful journey. And I think it's the awareness of the world to what we're doing and to the need to break the siege that we really want to emphasize.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Caroline. And I think all the solidarity to you. And I think this is very kind of important work that you're doing for the movement.
Fantastic. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine. While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse of the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets, please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words could never ever explain the raw tragedy. It's not a war, they're just murdering more rapidly, and we are automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if this was your family. Palestine remains in my heart forever. We stand for peace, times of war, we shan't surrender. Remember, it didn't start in this dark December. Every coin is a bullet if you're Marks and Spencer. And when you're sipping Coca-Cola, that's another pistol in the holster of them soulless soldiers. You say you know about the Zionist lobby, but you put money in their pocket when you're buying their coffee. Talking about revolution sitting in Starbucks. The fact is, that's the type of thinking I can't trust, let alone even start to respect. Before you talk, learn the meaning of that scarf on your neck. Forget Nestle, Obama promised Israel 30 billion over the next decade. They're trigger happy and they're crazy. Think about that when you're putting Huggies nappies on your baby. Just a war over stolen land. Why do you think little boys are throwing stones at tanks? And we'll never really know how many people are dead. They drop bombs on innocent girls while they sleep in their bed. Don't get offended by facts, just try and listen. Nothing is more anti-Semitic than Zionism. So please don't bring bad vibes when you speak to me. There's plenty of rabbis that agree with me. It's your choice what you do with this message. Don't get it confused, I view this from a human perspective. How many more resolutions have to be violated? How many more children have to be annihilated? Israel is a terror state, they're terrorists that terrorize. I testify, my television televise, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic genocide, but whatever they try, Palestine will never die. Sing it with me now. Free, free Palestine. 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 Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza.
That was Long Live Palestine by Lowkey. And sadly, we're coming to the end of the show. So I hope everyone listening enjoyed the program today. And we want to thank everyone for tuning in. We want to thank our guest, Caroline Smith, from the Global Movement to Gaza, and also Amanda Shweta Louie from the Socialist Party of Malaysia, talking about the commercialization of Malaysia's education system. And you can read more about all the stories we talked about today, plus videos and detailed analysis and book and music reviews at greenleft.org.au. And like always, we encourage anyone who isn't already to become a supporter of Green Left. It's very easy to do. You just go to greenleft.org.au/support and sign up for as little as $5 a month. We're not just simply joining protests and covering them in Green Left. I mean, sometimes we do that, but many of us are activists. We are organizing some of these protests. We are on the organizing committees of a diversity of campaigns that give voice to the oppressed. We cover the voices of refugees, of people who are fighting for the right to public housing, land back, any kind of social justice or environmental issue. We're there and we're involved in building the movements for change. So please keep supporting us. Come to Eco-Socialism as well, September 5th to 7th at the Balam Place in Brunswick.
Yeah, and I'd just also like to add that, I mean, I think it's Green Left is actually currently doing a supporter drive right now. We're actually trying to, you know, make the case for people to become financial supporters of Green Left, including subscribing to Green Left. And if you do want to kind of take the plunge, it's only like $5 a month or $10 a month. And you actually, if you're a new subscriber, you actually get the first month for free. So you can become a subscriber of Green Left for as low as $5 or $10 a month. Just go on the website on greenleft.org.au/support. But also, look, so make the case, if you're also enjoying 3CR, you should also become a subscriber of 3CR as well.
Yeah, you can just head to 3cr.org.au and Green Left is podcasted there as well.
Yeah. And just the last point to sort of say, I mean, essentially, you know, 3CR and Green Left rely on the financial contributions of ordinary people like you, you know, to keep radio, to keep media independent, free of corporate influence, and actually stand up for those those on the margins.
Yeah, catch you next week, same time, same place. Stay tuned for Left After Breakfast.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Morning Breakfast with Green Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
If you like our work, become a supporter from $5 per month at greenleft.org.au/support or free call 1-800-634-206.
Arise, you workers from your slumbers. Arise, you prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders and at last ends the age of Khan. Away with all your superstitions. Serve all masses.
Arise.
We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. That's
right. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.